Good evening, welcome to Miller Theater and to this concert at the Columbia University Orchestra. It's a pleasure tonight to talk about the program, but I'm actually going to talk about just one piece on the program, which occupies a large chunk of the program, the second half of the program, which is Sherbert's orchestration of Brahms' G minor piano quartet. And it's a special treat for me because although I've studied that piece a lot and even written about it, I've never heard it live in this version by Sherbert, so it's a treat because it's not done that often. And this piece, I noticed when I got the program tonight that you see the word Brahms here, and Schoenberg is just somewhere down on the third line. But in fact, he's a very important part of what we'll be hearing tonight. And it's interesting that the piece links two names, Brahms and Schoenberg, that we might not normally associate with one another. Our received images about these composers tend to put them fairly far apart, probably Brahms as the 19th century conservative traditionalist, Schoenberg as the radical modernist revolutionary. Of course, everybody sitting in this room who's taking music home or taking courses here knows that that's not the case, but certainly a lot of people still believe that. In fact, it's not accurate. Brahms himself, even in his day, was recognized as being quite advanced in terms of his harmony, his thematic style, many aspects of his music. Whereas Schoenberg, had trouble persuading people that it was true, but it was, that he was in fact quite conservative or traditional in many aspects of his music. He used older forms and genres. He wrote chamber music. He wrote in variation form. He wrote suites in a Baroque style, and so on. And in addition, Schoenberg was very respectful of and attached to earlier composers, especially those in the Austro-German tradition of which he saw himself a part, that tradition of Bach, Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, Brahms and Wagner. And Schoenberg paid homage to this tradition on numerous occasions throughout his life and career. As a teacher of music theory and composition, he focused almost exclusively on the great composers of this tradition, from Bach through Wagner. Almost never taught his own music to his students, either in Europe or in the United States. And interestingly enough, he also did full orchestral arrangements of a number of works by earlier composers, including some organ preludes and fugues of Bach. He also did an arrangement of a concerto grosso of Handel, arranged for string quartet and orchestra, and he took a keyboard concerto by the Baroque composer Matthias Mann and reworked it as a cello concerto on a commission from Pablo Casals. So Schoenberg was constantly engaged with the past in many ways throughout his career. Brahms was a particular passion and a cause for Schoenberg. He grew up in Vienna during the last 20 years of Brahms' life, and he and some of his other, the other young composers would often see the old man with his big, tall, you know, husky guy with his long white beard at concerts or walking through the streets of Vienna, and they were just in awe of Brahms. And in fact, they often sought to model their own compositions on Brahms, and they were proud of calling themselves the Brahmins in Vienna at the time. And Schoenberg was sort of one of that group, and he always maintained that respect and admiration for Brahms. They were very different generations. Brahms born in 1833, Schoenberg in 1874, and Brahms died in 1897, just as Schoenberg was coming into his own as a composer. In 1933, just before he emigrated from Germany, and shortly after Hitler came to power, Schoenberg delivered one of the last things he would sort of do in Germany, He delivered a radio address in honor of Brahms' 100th birthday in May of 1933, Brahms' centenary. And he called it Brahms the Progressive. That was the title of this lecture. And in this lecture, which later was written up as an essay and translated into English and it appears in his collection of writings, he talked about the many aspects of Brahms, thematic language, formal language, harmonic language that were, in fact, very advanced for the time. And it's one of the most famous pieces of writing by Schoenberg, one of the most famous pieces of writing about Brahms. And one can only imagine what he felt knowing that he would be leaving, probably sensing that he would be leaving that whole country, the country and the tradition behind. Within a few months, he would leave Germany for a new life in the United States, eventually settling in 1934 in Southern California. And even he left behind a lot of the cultural and musical traditions of the Austro-German sphere. In Los Angeles, Schoenberg plunged into many aspects of local culture and local life. He taught at USC and UCLA, developed many students. He played tennis with George Gershwin. He had considerable involvement with musicians and composers in Hollywood, even dabbled with writing thought about writing a score for a Hollywood film. He gave a speech, or was scheduled to deliver a speech, awarding the Oscar for the best musical score in the 1940s. So he certainly embraced many dimensions of American culture. But of course, he was still very much attached to what he had left behind. And the origins of the piece on tonight's program, the second half, are owed to his contact with another recent German emigre to the United States at the time, the great conductor Otto Klemperer, who had just arrived just about the same time as Schoenberg and became music director of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. And Schoenberg saw Klemperer's presence in California as an opportunity for making his own music, Schoenberg's music, better known, because he felt, with some justice, that it wasn't widely known in the United States. And in his later years, Klemperer recalled that Schoenberg was furious that Klemperer didn't perform more of his music. Schoenberg was often resentful. Klemperer explained to Schoenberg, quote, that the Los Angeles public was not yet ready for him, unquote. But in fact, Klemperer did program Schoenberg's Bach arrangements, the ones that I mentioned, and a suite in old style that Schoenberg had written while in the United States. And then Klemperer urged Schoenberg to write another transcription for a Brahms season being planned for 1937-38. And Schoenberg himself had conducted the Los Angeles Philharmonic in Brahms' Third Symphony in 1935, so it was already a connection there. So Schoenberg took the commission and settled on the G minor piano quartet, Opus 25, a work for piano and string quartet that Brahms had written in the early 1860s when he was not yet 30 years old. It's a fascinating choice of a work for Schoenberg to use. It's one of Brahms' biggest chamber works. It lasts almost 45 minutes. And it's also one of the works that helped make Brahms' reputation as a composer. He actually introduced himself, Brahms, to Vienna with this piece in 1862, not with a piano piece, not with a symphony, but with playing a piano quartet. So with this with this gesture, not only could Schoenberg pay musical homage to Brahms and introduce the public to a relatively little-known work, but also, and this was never far from Schoenberg's mind, he needed some money to pay off his mortgage and to support his families, both the one in Europe, his children in Europe, and his growing family in the United States. So he had a number of goals in mind when he did the Schoenberg arrangement. And then when he was asked by a California music critic why he'd undertaken this project, you have a quote from this in your program, actually, but I'll read a little more of the letter if I can find it here. He, of course, didn't mention that he wanted the money. What he said was, you have the initial quote, it was a music critic. He says, I like this piece. It is seldom played. It was always very badly played, because the better the pianist, the louder he plays, and you hear nothing from the strings. I once wanted to hear everything, and that I achieved. That's what Schoenberg said. And then he says, as far as his intentions, he said was he wanted to remain strictly in the style of Brahms and not go further than he himself would have gone had he lived today, number one. Number two, to watch carefully all the laws that Brahms obeyed and not to violate them, to violate any of those which are only known to musicians interested in his environment. And then his third thing he said, Schoenberg, how I did it. He said, I am for almost 50 years very thoroughly acquainted with Brahms' style and its principles, and I've analyzed many of his works for myself and with my pupils. I have played as a violist and cellist this work and many other chamber works. I therefore knew how it should sound, and I had only to transpose this sound to the orchestra, and this is in fact what I did. So that's what Schoenberg said to the music critic there. He sometimes would refer to his arrangement jokingly as Brahms' fifth. But in fact, it does not really sound at all like a Brahms symphony. The orchestral forces, as you'll hear, go well beyond those for Brahms' symphonies. We have woodwind threes, a big brass component, and especially an enormous percussion section, including glockenspiel, xylophone, triangle. Well, Brahms did use the triangle. Which piece? Fourth Symphony and I think the Academic Festival, or which are perhaps, but Brahms did not use the tambourine or the snare drum, the cymbals or the bass drum. So Brahms, Schoenberg really brings these things in. As with all his arrangements, what Schoenberg really has done is an act of composition and interpretation, even a kind of musical analysis. In this arrangement, Schoenberg's orchestra becomes a kind of commentator, and the principle that he's sort of applying, there's no single principle, but it's a notion that Schoenberg developed, actually I think in some ways his most important contribution to music of the 20th, even 21st century, is this notion he had of tone, color, melody, klang, farb, and melody, a term that Schoenberg coined to describe the way tone colors of the orchestra, or of whatever is playing, can really create structure and continuity in the absence of, or even more so than traditional pitch, rhythm, harmony, and that kind of thing. So this klang, farb, and melody is a very important concept, and Schoenberg's pupils also picked up on this and applied it to some arrangements. Webern has a famous orchestration of the Richerkar from Bach's musical offering, where the melodies are divided up among the different instruments. Now, Schoenberg is not as extreme as Webern, but he does a number of these things, as you might hear. Just two things I would highlight is that one thing he does is he takes motives that are there in the Brahms, like a tiny two-note figure, that appears often in Brahms, and in the original, a series of these is often played by one instrument as part of a kind of melodic continuity. But Schoenberg isolates and divides them among the orchestra, and so brings attention to this very motivic aspect of Brahms. That's one of the things he most admired about Brahms, was the motivic density and kind of concentration of Brahms' music. Something else that Schoenberg does, and this is in some ways even more adventurous, he invents contrapuntal lines or adds lines in that might bring out a thematic or motivic idea that might not be audible, or indeed are not really directly audible in the original. As he said in his letter, he wanted to hear everything, and he had very good ears, so he could hear things that other people didn't hear, Schoenberg. So he will take like the horn or some other instrument will play something, will sort of extract a melodic line from some kind of figuration that's there in the piano or another instrument in the original, and it relates to the other melodies that are heard. So it's sort of an active musical analysis and criticism that Schoenberg is doing, but it's never pedantic, it's always done in a very musical way. And there are many other touches that Schoenberg puts in, above all a sheer richness and exuberance to the scoring, especially in the last two movements. The middle section of the slow movement, the third movement, is a march, and it grows to something very, even in Brahms, it's quite extraordinary. This huge march-like segment grows to a big climax, and Schoenberg really goes to town with that. And he realizes it in some ways that might remind you of Mahler's symphonic marches, or maybe Shostakovich. These big thing, big sounds. And one writer has even suggested, I'm not sure about it, that Schoenberg was trying to evoke the goose-stepping soldiers of Hitler's armies. Obviously not in a positive way, but of course this was 1937, 1938. And then there is the Gypsy Rondo, the last movement, which is one of Brahms' great movements inspired by Hungarian music, gypsy music. There's a lot of Brahms' Hungarian dances and other things. This is the one movement Brahms specifically mentions. He calls it Rondo alla Zingarese, Brahms, and it's a whole movement based on gypsy rhythms, phrases that are not the normal lengths, and it's wonderful in the original, and Schoenberg really, really has a magnificent realization of it. That's where the tambourine comes in. That's probably as close as Schoenberg ever gets to Carmen, Bizet's Carmen. He's using the tambourine in the finale. So this arrangement was a great success, and Klemperer liked it so much, as in the program you can read that he, at one point he said, well, one does not want to listen to the original quartet anymore. Well, I'm not sure about that. But interesting that Schoenberg's student and a pioneering composer from California, Lou Harrison, praised this arrangement as, quote, perhaps the most penetrating, emphatic, and beautiful orchestration as such ever made. Interesting, coming from a great composer of klang, farb, and melody himself. And the piece had new life in the 1960s with a ballet that Balanchine made in the New York York City Ballet Brahms Schoenberg Quartet, which is still in the repertory and is done there. I want to just mention, and I think I'll close with that, one document that I found in doing my research about Brahms and Schoenberg, and this was among Arnold Schoenberg's papers, which were at that time at the University of Southern California, they now reside in Vienna. I found a little slip of paper which says a lot about how he viewed tradition and his relationship to it, and his himself as part of a tradition. Just to explain the background of it, is that in Vienna, and it's been reproduced in a number of books, Brahms biographies, is a fan, that's something you fan yourself with, that belonged to the stepdaughter of the great Viennese waltz king, Johann Strauss. And at one point, Brahms was a great admirer of Strauss and would hang out with Johann Strauss sometimes. She asked Brahms if he would sign her fan, autograph her fan, Elise Strauss. So what Brahms did is he wrote on this fan, he wrote out the theme of the Blue Danube Waltz. And underneath it he wrote, Leider nicht von Johannes Brahms. Unfortunately not by Johannes Brahms. So, and this image has been reproduced, and Schoenberg must have seen it at some point, perhaps in a biography of Brahms or Strauss. And on this slip of paper I found among the Schoenberg papers, Schoenberg sort of imitates Brahms' signature, and he writes Leider nicht von Johannes Brahms in the Blue Danube theme. And then he writes the first measures of the Brahms piano quartet that we'll hear tonight. And above it in German, he writes Leider von Johannes Brahms, and underneath in English, he writes only orchestrated by Arnold Schoenberg. So I think it says a lot about the reverence he had and respect for tradition that he doodled. It's really basically a doodle on a page, but it's when I saw it, I thought, wow, that's really cool. So I hope you enjoy the whole program tonight, and I hope my comments help you understand this unusual and stunning piece that we'll hear in the second half, the orchestration of the Brahms Piano Quartet by Schoenberg. Thank you, and enjoy the concert.